It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's a culinary contradiction, something that's hard to get your head around. Vegan soul food. As in soul food without pork or fried chicken. Well, a gentle food activist, Bryant Terry, takes the food of his childhood down a pretty timely path. His book is Vegan Soul Kitchen. Well, for the Stearns, it's a Jack Kerouac hangout, the M&M Cigar Store in Butte, Montana. Cheese maven Steve Jenkins brings us the cheeses that separate the dabblers from the fanatics. Then it's a lover's grief eased by food without the usual schmaltz. And we've got the big reveal, the secret culinary codes that only the pros know. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and supported by Wiley, publishers of So Easy by Ellie Krieger. Simple, nutritious recipes for every meal of the week. So Easy by Ellie Krieger, available everywhere now for Mother's Day. Well, today we talk with Bryant Terry. Now, he's a cook who has cleverly fused together his food politics and his heritage. Now, that's soul food with no animal products. His book is Vegan Soul Kitchen, Fresh, Healthy, and Creative African-American Cuisine. The highly opinionated cheesemonger Steve Jenkins talks about wonderfully stinky bits of brilliance, washed rind cheeses. Writer Suzanne Perrette stumbles into the truth of the Cervantes saying, "All sorrows are less with bread." And then it's the magic wand of a cook's success. Food writer Michael Ruhlman explains the ratio. It could put most of your recipe books out of business. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern of roadfood.com. Hey, Jane, Michael, have you guys been out west lately?
Oh, God, we revisited what truly has to be my favorite bar in the world. It's the M&M in Butte, Montana, and it's been there forever.
100 years.
100 years. Closed for a little bit in 2003. And I think, didn't Jack Kerouac once describe it as the end of the quest for the ideal bar?
Yeah, this was his ideal. When he hit the M&M back when he was writing On the Road, mm-hmm. he said, "This is it. This is what I've been looking for." And if you have an appreciation for a real old Western bar populated by an unbelievably motley assortment of characters, this is the place to go.
It was a place where, and I'm not kidding, Lynn, this isn't hyperbole. I walked through the door. And I was riveted to the spot. I could not move because there were old timers at the bar. I'm sure coal miners from Butte and cowboys. There was not one person at the bar who wasn't missing a body part. There was one guy with one ear, one guy with nine fingers, one guy with one leg. And,
these are hardworking people.
At first, I was actually scared when I went in there. And then I realized that everybody was, in fact, filled with Western hospitality.
But this sounds, I'm surprised with Kerouac mentioning it and you guys mentioning it, that this hasn't been overrun with tourists.
Well, Butte is not a huge tourist attraction kind of town. You know, it's...
It was called the ugliest town in America,
really?
A number of years ago, which of course had Jane Michael Stern run screaming
we
to
love it
instantly and found it to be a culinary destination.
I would guess that there are some tourists who come, but the nature of the place is that anyone who walks in instantly becomes part of the scene as opposed mm-hmm. to being an observer of the mm-hmm. scene. I mean, it's mm-hmm. not just a bar. You know, being in Montana, they've got slot machines and it's lit with neon inside and out. It's kind of it's surreal. It's a surreal place that you can't help get absorbed into.
And because it is a mining town or an ex-mining town, Michael, didn't one of the neighborhoods fall into the
Yes, there used to, you know, Butte once was like a huge multi-ethnic community, and it still is to some degree, with the conspicuous exception of Italian food, because many decades ago, the Italian neighborhood fell into one of the open
pits. Oh, no!
And that was the end of it.
Oh, dear! But because it is a mining town, on Thursdays, they have pasties, you know, which are, were the classic miner dish that the guys would, you know, wrap in a handkerchief and bring down to the coal mine and heat up on a shovel over a flame.
It's also – the M&M, we should say, is always open, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So I would go there for breakfast if you have a choice of meals. Mm-hmm. They make really good pancakes, great big omelets, good hash browns on the side. If you have dinner there, the one dish that I had that I really liked was liver and onions. Not elegant liver and onions, but that hearty diner kind of liver and onions.
Yeah.
Really good.
It certainly was the end of our quest for the ideal bar.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
We got cowboys. We got truckers. Broken-hearted fools and suckers. And we got hustlers. We got fighters. Early birds and all-nighters. And the veterans talk about their battle scars.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you know the Sterns are here every week, but you don't have to wait a week to get their food finds. Just check them out anytime on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to also check out all of our other offerings, our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcasts, information on our book, How to Eat Supper, and find a selection of inexpensive recipes to get you cooking in your kitchen. This week, why not take a look at the recipe for masa crepes with chard, chilies, and cilantro? It's all there on the website, splendidtable.org. Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins knows his stuff firsthand. I think when Steve started tracking down the best of the artisan cheesemakers, the earth was still cooling. And he's still at it. He's foraging for the Fairway Markets in New York City. Steve's latest book is The Food Life. Hey, Steve, it's good to have you back.
Thank you, Lynn.
How do you define a washed rind cheese?
The washed rind cheeses, Lynn, are the stinkers, the ones that your kids go, Mom, Dad, what is that? Get that out of here. It's the really smelly things like Munster and Epoisse and Langres and Livarot and Pont-l'Evêque and Taleggio and Gorgonzola and on and on and on. Any batch of milk can be turned into a washed rind cheese via a certain recipe. You know, cheese is like anything else in the kitchen. They all have recipes.
Right, exactly.
And what it is with washed rind cheeses is that after you've curded it up and strained away most of the whey, and you've got this nascent infant cheese,
right,
what you then do is the real alchemy of cheese making is you caress the rind in some fashion and you age the cheese and put it away and think about it and make it think about itself. And with washed rind, what you do is apply some liquid to the exterior. And you do that with either your hands or a cloth or a brush, or you literally soak the cheese in the liquid.
Mm-hmm.
And the liquid can be water, it can be brine, it can be wine, any kind of wine. It can be a brandy, any kind of distilled spirits. It can be some kind of fruit juice. It can be an herb-infused liquid. Whatever it is that you choose to be the bathing medium for that washed rind cheese, it's going to influence the interior flavor because that moisture feeds the bacteria. It hydrates them. It makes them alive.
Mm-hmm.
They multiply like crazy because of that moisture on the outside, and it affects the way the molecules begin to fuse together in the interior of the cheese, and that is how you get flavor. So the washed rind cheese is the most overt way that a great cheesemaking lady or man can make that cheese slap you across the face to get your attention. That's washed rind cheeses.
That's a pretty vivid description, I have to say.
But you know, I think about it a lot. It's really alchemy, the way washed rind cheeses become so excruciatingly delicious.
Aren't these sort of the most temperamental of all the cheeses? I think of them as being fragile because they can kind of go over the hill quickly, or they can take a wrong turn.
No? They're fragile physically because they're always soft. It's a cheese that's not meant to be long aged. These are cheeses that are meant to be eaten after a month or two maximum of ripening, and in some cases just a matter of weeks. So these are the cheeses that really make me crazy. The ones that are gushy and have that inarticulable fragrance that most people consider an odor. Not mm-hmm. a fragrance, mm-hmm. but then also they glisten at you, and they're alternately crumbly and runny at the same time, and they're cheeses that you can poke shards of bread at rather than having to employ some piece of cutlery to cut off a shard of it.
All right, Steve, can you pick three you want us to try?
Oh, that's so hard. Yeah, I can, yes.
I know. I never do anything easy with you.
And they also, I know, Lynn, but they also got to be cheeses for you hicks out there in the middle of nowhere to be able to get your hands on. You know, I'm a very sophisticated New Yorker.
All right.
It's got to be stuff that you guys can find, or what the heck's the worth of talking about it.
I know
you can find Gorgonzola. There's nothing I like more than Gorgonzola from Lombardy. And so many people have heard that word, and it's sort of weird to them, and they think it's something they won't like because it's sort of an ugly word, but I think it's a gorgeous word.
Well, it's a blue cheese.
Secondarily, a blue cheese. Primarily, Gorgonzola is a washed rind cheese. And it's succulent and soft and glistening and will ooze at you if it's not the aged one, which is firmer.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say everybody can get their hands on Gorgonzola. You can even get your hands on that Bel Gioioso brand out there in Wisconsin that's made by the great Errico Arricchio. And that Gorgonzola is as good or better than any Gorgonzola I've ever had in Italy.
Okay, number two.
I'd also say get your hands on this Torta del Cazar. It's so drop dead that they call it a cake, a torta, and it's bound in a strip of burlap so that it'll hold together. If it didn't have that strip of burlap around the 3-pound wheel, the thing would just ooze off onto the floor. Torta del Cazar, Casar, and you'll find that in any shop that's serious about cheese. And you'll find Alsatian Munster, Munster d'Alsace, the original monastery cheese. That's where the word Munster comes from. There's no M-U-E-N-S-T-R. That's something that they sell in delis for bad sandwiches. This is Munster, M-U-N-S-T-E-R, from Alsace. And that's the real great washed rind stinker, original, the most excruciatingly delicious substance you'll ever put in your mouth. There's three that are pretty much readily available.
For those of us who live in the sticks, yes, thank you.
My pleasure.
Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins can be found behind the cheese counters at Fairway Markets in New York City. But you can find Steve's cheese picks and his recipe for runny cheese potatoes on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, if you want a salad with those cheesy potatoes, keep it cheese and wine friendly by dressing it with verjuice. Now, verjuice is the juice of unripe grapes. It can be tart or sweet tart and have really nice complex flavors, but it also is very gentle. Use it instead of vinegar and dressings. Use it as a base for sauces and marinades over fruits. And by the way, it's also a good non-alcohol drink, especially with some fizzy water and a shot of lime. Now, verjuice is nothing new. It's been around since man first pressed a grape for wine. The way it's made explains how it probably was first created. When winemakers thin their vines so that a few grape clusters are going to get all the nourishment, the green grapes that they cut away can be pressed into verjuice. So keep an eye out for it. More and more winemakers are beginning to sell it. Coming up, soul food for vegans and the rest of us, and the key to cooking without recipes. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Vegan and soul food are about as unlikely a pairing as Cocoa Puffs and cognac, but food activist and eco-chef Brian Terry takes it on in his new book, Vegan Soul Kitchen, Fresh, Healthy, and Creative African-American Cuisine. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So, Brian, deciding to become a vegan, where does that come from for you?
Well, I'll say this. You know, I on the continuum of consumption with my eating habits, I've been everything from an omnivore to a vegetarian to a vegan to a fruitarian. I think I tried breatharianism for a day. And because I've kind of understood this dietary journey is very fluid and shifting and changing as I needed it to, I choose for political reasons not to give my diet a title. I just eat what I eat. And, you know, I like good food. That's why the name of my first book was Grub, because I don't care how healthy the food is. If it's not delicious, then I don't want it. And I think most people feel that way. And so I really encourage people to think about, you know, I keep a food journal, and I encourage other people to just kind of document what foods you're eating, how they make you feel, not only physically, but, you know, mentally, emotionally, psychologically, if you will. And then use that as a way of determining what foods you might want to consume more of, what foods you might want to cut out, and just not being so rigid, because I think when we box ourselves in, we can often have an unhealthy relationship with food.
Interesting idea. You know, it's hard for me, though, when I think of soul food, to imagine it without the deliciousness of that pork fat, you know, the fat back cooked with the collards. And I don't mean to stereotype it, but ribs, you know, my mouth waters, fried chicken, that kind of thing. And I understand that this idea of food with soul is a lot more complex. But how do you pull that off without using those products?
Well, when I talk about soul food, it's probably different than what most people imagine when they hear soul food. Unfortunately, over the past four decades, I think African-American cuisine, or soul food as it's popularly called, has been reduced to the comfort foods, the deep fried fatty meats, sugary desserts. And, you know, these certainly were foods that I ate growing up on holidays, on special occasions. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the food that my family and many of the families in our community were eating on an everyday basis, it was food that was as fresh as, you know, being harvested right before the meal, as local as a backyard garden, and as seasonal as whatever was in season. That's what we were eating, except for, you know, the stuff that my grandmother pickled and preserved from the summer. So, you know, it's really hearkening back to these older ways that I think a lot of African Americans were eating before we saw our food system become industrialized. But in terms of, you know, having like the bacon grease and the greens, you know, I feel like it's an easy way out. You know, it does enhance the flavor. But I think if you have some more interesting cooking techniques and take a little time to really cook what I understand is slow food in the African-American tradition, you can, you know, kind of pull out the same delicious flavors without adding the animal products.
Brian, could you pick one dish that represents soul food to most of us that you've changed in a way that speaks to the way you cook?
It would probably be the citrus collards with raisins recipe. You know, I know that might sound a little strange. In my family growing up, most of the time when we had collard greens, they were cooked for at least 4 hours until they were actually, they weren't even green anymore. They were like brown, beige-ish color. And, you know, they were delicious. I won't deny it. But I really wanted to present this kind of staple of African-American cuisine in a new, fresh, modern, interesting way. So I decided to just blanch it in salted boiling water very quickly and then saute it with a little garlic and olive oil, sprinkle it with some sea salt, and then finish it off with some raisins and a little citrus. And, you know, for me, more than kind of giving it a sweet variation, the raisins, the orange juice, they really serve as a metaphor for the direction that I envision African-American cuisine heading in the 21st century. You know, I really want to be more creative, more cutting edge, and refreshing.
There's something in the book that's quite unusual. Every single recipe is accompanied by a specific suggestion for a piece of music. And the other thing is that where normally you would have the foreword or the preface, there's a song complete with a score here. Why?
Yes. I grew up in a very musical family. My grandfather started a traveling quartet in the 50s. And so because of that, all of his children were musical, you know, my mother, all her siblings. So my Uncle Don, who's a pretty popular singer-songwriter from the 70s, wrote this song for my aunt, I Can't Stand the Rain, which has been covered and popularized by a lot of people. You know, I wanted him to compose a song that would open the book up to simply help people to be present and think about all the forces that help get our food to our plate. The elements, the people working in the fields, the transporters, the chefs, the servers. And music is so intimately wrapped up with my relationship with food. You know, growing up in the South, when we had family gatherings with food, we had talent shows. People were playing the piano and singing. And, you know, when I'm cooking, I'm always playing music and spinning old jazz on vinyl. So I really wanted to share that and just show the beautiful connections with food, music, art, culture, community, and hopefully inspire people to reignite those traditions or start those traditions in their own families and communities.
Brian, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Lynn. It's been a pleasure.
Brian Terry is author of Vegan Soul Kitchen. He is a fellow of the Kellogg Foundation's Food and Society Program. Now, you can get his recipe for citrus collards with raisin redux on the website, splendidtable.org.
I can't stand the rain against my window, bringing back sweet memories. Hey, window pane, remember how sweet it used to be.
Okay, I confess, I occasionally tear up at farmers markets. It's the sense of community and rightness and generosity. I mean, there are few places that feel so safe. Surprisingly safe at times, as writer Suzanne Perrette discovered one sad day.
It was 7 o'clock in the morning when the phone rang. It was my boyfriend's mother, which was unusual. I thought about bolting across my studio apartment to answer it, but as I listened to her voice on my answering machine, I knew something was wrong. If I had to deal with something big that day, I needed to prepare for it. I needed my strength. I went back to sleep. 3 days later, I walked into his family's church, haunted. My eyes were practically swollen shut, and I couldn't focus much on anything. Drifting through a low-grade murmur, I made my way over to his coffin. Seeing him made up like a drag queen was shocking. I knelt in front of him and held his cold, rock-like hand. I leaned in and kissed his lips. I placed my favorite picture of the two of us inside his suit pocket. Everyone deals with tragedy differently. I decided to return to my waitressing job on 15th and 5th in Manhattan, but after I spent several continuous days of stuttering to customers, tears incessantly streaming down my face, they suggested that it might be wise to take some time off. I hadn't really eaten much since my last meal of toast and Bustelo coffee the morning of that phone call. I had been subsisting mostly on a diet of cigarettes, coffee, and any sedative I can finagle without resorting to a prescription. Food never entered my mind. After a good month of complete solitude, I slowly began to integrate into the world. I started getting compliments from all the girls I hated. You look great. Wow, you've never looked better. Which was disturbing because my clothes were hanging off me, I had a hacking cough from Marlboro Red-induced emphysema, and I hadn't slept in weeks. I was in bad shape and knew I needed to begin again somewhere. So I stepped over the pile of Fassbender and Bergman films in my den of morning hell and chain-smoked my way to the farmer's market in Union Square, hacking along the way. Now, I'd like to wax lyrical over what some would describe as pure sensory overload. The vibrancy of ebullient colors, smells, and sounds, beginning with the array of summer fruits in all their blazing glory, crimson red to deep purple berries, bursting next to heaping cartons of fat and juicy blueberries and just-plucked cherries, serene beneath the sunny, beaming faces of 4-foot-tall sunflowers. but all I remember was the smell of steaming piss emanating from Union Square Station below on a sweltering, brutal August day. I walked over to the pretzel lady. She looked at me slightly aghast. I mean, I knew I looked bad, but jeez. She gave me a bag of broken pretzels, gratis. You can use them, she said. I nibbled on a few and walked over to the cheese man. I handed him a $10 bill for a small tub of goat cheese drizzled with olive oil and topped with pink and black peppercorns. Along with my change, he threw in a hunk of something else. It's my homemade sheep's. I think you'll like it, he winked. Hey, darling, he gestured to the woman a few stalls over. That's my daughter, he said, and smiled proudly as she handed him a baguette. He threw that into my bag, too. I backed away and continued over to a fruit and vegetable vendor, where I paid for a pint of heirloom tomatoes and two peaches, but also walked away with a handful of opal basil, a few sprigs of mint, and a perfectly contorted yellow summer squash. They just kept chucking things into my bag. I really thought they all pitied me, but realized it was the end of the day and they just needed to get rid of the stuff. Now, I won't indulge a foodie sentimentality that I was resurrected by the farmer's market, because I wasn't. But I will admit that when I came upon this particular fork in the road, it was the wiser choice.
I've been lost inside my head. Echoes fall off me. I took the prize last night for complicatedness, for saying things I didn't mean and don't believe.
Suzanne Perret is author of The Pleasure Is All Mine, Selfish Food for a Modern Life. Now, for Suzanne's recipe for wild mushrooms on grilled ciabatta with aioli, check out the website, splendidtable.org. You know that old bit about it's not what you do, but how you do it? Well, in cooking, it's not finding that great recipe. It's knowing the secrets of its ratios. These are the cooking codes that professional cooks use all the time. And this is what Michael Ruhlman delivers in his latest book. It's called Ratio, The Simple Codes Behind the Craft of Everyday Cooking. Michael, good to have you back.
Delight to be back, Lynn.
So, Michael, start us at the beginning. Why are ratios so important?
Ratios form the backbone of the culinary arts. They teach us about cooking. They free us from recipes. They allow us to improvise and to cook intuitively. A culinary ratio is simply a fixed proportion of one ingredient or ingredients relative to another. Bread dough, for instance, is 5 parts flour, 3 parts water. You need a little yeast, you need a little salt, but that's variable, so it's not part of the ratio. Now, if you add some fat to that, it becomes a pie dough. And if you add some sugar to that fat and that flour-water mixture, you can have a kind of cookie. So if you understand these ratios, you understand the whole that a bread dough is not that much different from a pasta dough, is not that much different from a pie dough or a biscuit or a cookie dough. That is the principle behind ratio.
Okay, so now we've got, once you've got these ratios down, you can play a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. So if I want to make, let's talk pie dough, because I think that's the thing that, first of all, you know, I make pie dough all summer, and I think it's the thing that most people find to be a stumbling block.
They do, and they shouldn't, and I wish they wouldn't. And if you know that the pie dough ratio is 3-2-1, it's often even called this in cookbooks, 3 parts flour, 2 parts fat, 1 part liquid. You don't even need a recipe for pie dough. And so when I'm going to make a pie, I'll make 12 ounces of flour.
Right.
8 ounces of butter, 2 sticks of butter for a nice, rich, buttery crust.
Right.
And 1 part ice water. You want cold water in pie doughs. And those come together in a matter of, you know, less than 60 seconds. And there, because you don't want to overwork pie dough, or it can be, it can become tough, mm-hmm. you have a pie dough literally in 60 to 90 seconds. You didn't need to open a book. You have a bowl and a scale and a couple of sticks of butter, and you're good to go.
It's fabulous. And if I wanted to add a little sugar to that, it would be okay.
Of course, because you've stuck to this the fundamental ratio. If you wanted to add some, say you're making up savory pie,
right.
You could add some Parmesan Reggiano to that for some extra flavor.
Or herbs, right?
Or herbs would be fantastic. Absolutely. It allows you to improvise in exactly that way.
I can't wait to drop this at a party, you know, in the middle of summer and make a wonderful pie. And someone says, how fabulous. I can say, oh, it's a mere 3-2-1. And go on from there.
Perfect.
Hey, Michael.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Oh, always a pleasure, Lynn.
Michael Ruhlman is author of Ratio, The Simple Codes Behind the Craft of Everyday Cooking. Now, for Michael's pie dough ratio and recipe, get thee to the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time to open the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We got a very sweet voicemail this week. Have a listen.
Hi, my name's Shamoli, and I'm 10 years old, and I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I have to do a report on France, and I'm looking for a couple recipes that are really simple, but a lot of people like them. That they don't involve snails, because I think those are gross. Thank you.
Shamoli, I kind of agree about the snails. Now, there's a recipe. If you make this, you won't need more than one recipe. Everybody's going to love it. How about chocolate mousse? Absolutely the most favorite dessert in all of France. And this is so easy, it's silly. You take 8 ounces of chocolate. Now, that's 2 chocolate bars of semi-sweet chocolate that are 4 ounces each, okay? And you break them up. And this is how you can break them up. It's kind of fun. Don't open the package. Just put them on the counter and just tap them with the back of a saucepan so that that'll break up the chocolate. Take that saucepan then and put 2 cups of heavy cream in it and you warm it. And that means you want it to be warm enough that you just see teeny, teeny bubbles around the edge of the pan. All right? Take it off the heat and then just open those packages, dump the chocolate into the cream and stir it with a spoon or a whisk until it's absolutely smooth. You don't see any flecks of chocolate in it. And then what you can do is you can put about a teaspoon of vanilla extract if you want. Now, pour that into a bowl and chill it. And when you take it to school for your class, give everybody just a little bit. It's very, very, very rich, but it's really good. So make chocolate mousse. They're going to love it. And thanks for the call, Shamoli. Okay, it is time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, this week it's a toughie. The question is, what was the pasta prank played by the BBC back in 1957? Well, we're going to be back in a moment with that answer and more of your calls. Get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be back to your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what was the pasta prank played by the BBC back in 1957? Well, it was April 1st, 1957, on a BBC news show called Panorama. This was a serious show, perhaps close to the Jim Lehrer NewsHour. Now, they did a segment on the bumper spaghetti harvest in Switzerland with a video of Swiss farmers picking spaghetti off trees. The commentator observed, and this is a quote, "For those who love this dish, there is nothing like real homegrown spaghetti." Well, here's the fun part. Swarms of people called the BBC asking how they could plant their own spaghetti tree. And the response was, place a sprig of spaghetti in a tin of tomato sauce and hope for the best. Okay, enough. Let's get back to your calls now. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see. We have got Lauren calling from Plainfield, Vermont. Hey, Lauren, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, my husband and I, we raise pastured pigs and periodically sort of mix up the way we get them butchered. And this time I have a bunch of sliced pork belly, so it's, you know, hasn't been cured as bacon, which I've been experimenting with. But it's hard to find recipes for sliced pork belly. You see a lot of recipes for, you know, the pork belly itself.
Right, right.
Wondering what, you know, if anything jumps out at you. And it's one of those, I don't know why we decided to go with the sliced pork belly this time, but we did, and I've just been having fun kind of trying different things. So,
well, you know, I mean, essentially with the sliced pork belly, you can do what you would do with a whole pork belly, but it's going to cook a little faster.
Right.
You know, I mean, so many pork belly recipes are you marinate the pork and then you put it in a low oven, you know, 300 degrees, you cover it, you let it cook. You may uncover it and let it brown or glaze.
Right.
But because it's thin sliced, or it's,
yes.
How thick are the slices?
They're not very thick, you know, kind of like bacon
okay.
slices already.
First thing you could do is you could really make almost your own pancetta. So you toss that with a bit of salt and sugar and whatever spices you'd like. Put that in the fridge with some air circulating around it.
Mm-hmm.
I would put it on like a cake rack over a pan.
Okay.
And lightly cover it. You still want some air. And I'd leave that for maybe a day.
Okay.
In the fridge, maybe two. And then what I would do is I would lightly rinse it. Now, it's not going to keep forever, but now you've got something that is seasoned.
Right.
Pat it dry, and now you can use it as really tasty salt pork or something like pancetta.
That's, what proportion of salt would you use?
Okay, for 2 pounds of this thin sliced pork, I would use probably something like, this is off the top of my head.
Yeah.
I would check some cookbooks for this. But because it's thin sliced, I would probably use something like 6 ounces of salt, kosher
okay.
salt,
yeah.
coarse salt. Nothing iodized, and I'd probably use about 3 ounces of sugar.
Okay.
Probably a couple of tablespoons of lightly cracked black peppercorns and some bay leaves.
Okay.
Okay, you could throw other things in there.
Yeah.
But the idea is you want that salt to lightly permeate.
Right.
And you would toss that so it was lightly coated.
Would, being from Vermont here, would, instead of sugar, if we did some maple, would that
be too You could do that.
Wet,
sure.
Or?
No, I don't think it would be too wet. Uh-uh. And the idea is spread it on that screen so that it's not just all stacked and wadded together, but spread out a bit.
Yeah.
Keep some air circulating around it. Keep it cool, really cool. So then you lightly rinse that, you pat it dry. Now you could, what you could do is you could freeze it like 3 or 4 pieces per little tight plastic bag.
Oh, okay.
All right, and then pull it out when you want to saute that into a pasta sauce. Now, if
right.
you have the maple flavoring, it's going to limit your usage.
Right.
Yeah, by the way, you don't need the sugar or sweetness at all if you don't want it.
Okay,
but now there's another way to do this. The masters of fat and all the fabulous textures and flavors you can get out of it are the Chinese.
Mm.
And there is a dish that my mouth waters at the thought. You don't see it that much these days on Chinese menus. It used to be very popular. You can check it out in a lot of cookbooks, though. Two dishes, twice cooked pork and
okay.
thrice cooked pork.
Okay.
And this is usually done with the belly. Sometimes the recipe will call it five flour pork, which is what some areas of China call the pork belly, because evidently there are 5 layers between the lean and the fat and the lean and the fat. But this is the basic idea. The pork belly, and this will just happen quicker because you have slices, is simmered for anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour. It's then drained, patted dry. It is either rubbed with some kind of marinade and let to sit for a little while, or it is cut up. In this case, you've already got it cut. You could cut it into short lengths if you wanted.
Okay.
And then for twice cooked, it is either deep fried and then blended lightly with a stir-fried sauce that may have vegetables in it, spices, etc.
Okay.
Or it is stir-fried with those vegetables and makings of a sauce.
Right.
And often it's strong flavors. It might be,
yeah.
You know, fermented bean paste or whatever. And don't be put off by that.
Okay.
When it all comes together, it's fabulous.
Yeah. Oh, I can't wait. We send out recipes to our customers periodically, so
well, check
this
out,
might have to be one of them.
Yeah, check out. I mean, the old cookbook I love is Gloria Blaine Miller's 1,000 Recipe Chinese Cookbook. It's been out, though, for 20 years. The other thing is thrice-cooked pork is slightly different. With thrice-cooked pork, you still do that simmer, okay, to tenderize it. Then what you do is you stir-fry it with flavorings.
Okay.
And then you steam it for an hour. When you get done, you have more complex flavors,
right,
and it's fabulous. But either way, this is where I think pork belly shines like
oh,
nothing
good.
Else.
Well, thank you. That definitely gives
You've
me
now got more
ideas.
Ways to do it than you can shake a stick at.
Yes, absolutely.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Call us 800-537-5252 or go to splendidtable.org and send us an email. Now, we got an email from Peggy in Edina, Minnesota, and she wanted to know, do I have any information on bacalao? Her sister-in-law prepared it for her when she was visiting her sister-in-law in Norway, but the sister-in-law said that really the dish and the bacalao was Spanish. Bacalao is salt cod. Now, the interesting thing about this is that I think his salt cod, by the way, is all over the Mediterranean. But the Norwegians and the Dutch were the ones who were generally catching it and then selling it to people in the Mediterranean. So it sounds like it's gone full circle. Go to a fish store, call around to fish stores and say you're looking for salt cod. Now, what this is going to be is salted dried cod. And what you have to do with it is that you put it in cold water to cover, and you soak it for 3 days. Change the water about three times a day, whenever you think about it, and keep it in the refrigerator, all right? And then to do it Spanish style, I'm making an assumption here, but generally that means olive oil, sautéing onion, and maybe some roasted peppers in that, adding garlic, and then I would add some good Spanish paprika. It might be the smoky kind. It's called pimenton, and you'll find it at a lot of grocery stores these days. Okay, and then what you do, you would add cooked potatoes that you slice with tomatoes, like a tomato sauce, and you would just let that simmer until everything tastes delicious. Slip in that cod and let it cook about an hour. And you do that covered. It's like a stew, and that cod will sit there in a solid piece, and it will cook away. An alternative is you could have sautéed the cod with the olive oil and then added everything. And it's going to have a salty undertone, but the tomatoes, you see, work against that. And you can sprinkle the whole thing with lemon juice if you want. So that would be your bacala in the Spanish style. And thanks for the email, Peggy. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have got Jess on the line from Bisbee, Arizona. Jess, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I have kind of a strange question. I belong to a historical reenactment group that recreates the Middle Ages. And I'm very interested in both Mongolian history and culture and cooking. And they intersect at this very strange point that's kind of a large furry animal called a marmot.
Now, wait a minute. You're saying, okay, so we're talking Mongolia, medieval period, and what they ate?
Yes, exactly.
A marmot?
Yes. It's a traditional delicacy. In fact, it's still eaten today among the nomadic cultures in Mongolia.
Uh-huh.
And I live out in the middle of Arizona where we do actually have ground chucks, but I'm not quite that adamant about truth in cooking. I'm not really going to go out and hunt one myself. So what domestically available meat might most closely resemble marmot in taste and texture?
Okay, I have never eaten marmot. I have had squirrel. And I'm thinking now, you know what, since I don't know the animal, okay, I'm just going to make a very uneducated guess. I try chicken thighs. And,
really?
And this
okay.
is this is my thinking. I have eaten squirrel.
Mm-hmm.
And chicken thighs, first of all, they're the most forgiving thing to cook because they have so much, they have a bit of fat, their consistency, they can be very, very tasty. And I think there is a resemblance between them and, for instance, domesticated rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying they taste exactly the same. I'm just saying that there is something that links them in taste to me.
Okay.
Now, rabbit would probably be another good bet.
That's I was kind of guessing. I did some research, and they said that in taste, the Europeans and Americans who've tasted marmot compare it to like wild duck or lamb with a distinct rodent tang. And I'm not really certain how to replicate that distinct rodent tang.
The rodent part is the thing. All right. Now, wild duck I've had, and wild duck is delicious. And it has, I hate the word gamey because people mm-hmm. associate it with awfulness. It's a very full-bodied meat. Okay. So if we're thinking it tastes like wild duck, first of all, you could do lamb.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do something like lamb shoulder.
Okay.
The other thing that you could do is you could actually use duck, domesticated duck.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that you could do is use my chicken thighs, which will probably be the least expensive of those things,
mm-hmm.
but do a marinade. Because I would imagine that almost all of those dishes either are going to be very, very simple. They'll be roasted because we're talking about a nomadic people.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they don't have sophisticated cooking, but probably their main techniques are either you put it in a pot and you cook it with some kind of liquid and other ingredients, or you roast it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to see a lot of, you know, very finesse pan sauteing or that kind of thing.
Oh, great. Well, thank you, Lynn.
You are welcome, ma'am, and enjoy this. This is great. 10th century Mongolian woman. I love it.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye, Jess. Call us, 800-537-5252. There's a new food lover website that offers something a little different. What eHarmony and JDate and Match.com have really missed, and that is the most important matching information for finding your true love. Food. Your preferences. What you're really looking for in a prospective partner. TuttiFoodie.com is the name of the site, and Lisa Schiffman is the brains behind the Personals column. Lisa, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
So tell me basically about what the site is about.
The site is a once-weekly feature for adventurous foodies. It doesn't mean you have to cook. It just means you have to love experiences that are a little bit out of the box.
Uh-huh.
It's a free article that reaches your inbox every Wednesday about food, spirits, culinary travel, contests, and recently, love.
Now, was this your brainstorm, the love?
It is. It absolutely is.
I love this. Wedding date needed. Seriously, the chef friend I love to hate is getting married next month, and I need a guy whose looks could kill to join me at her wedding. And then there's an email address. So give me some more examples of the kinds of things that people are submitting.
We always have a blend, gay, straight, old, young.
Uh-huh.
It's modeled after the British personals, where people aren't always cheery like Americans are. It not only has to cover food, but one of your kind of gnarly idiosyncrasies. So, for example, control freak in the kitchen looking for submissive cook. male, 40-ish, boyish, gay, cultured, and with impeccable taste in takeout menus, seek same, except younger.
Have you heard of any successes?
I have. There have been no marriages. There have been no knife wounds in the kitchen. But people are really, really having fun because, as we all know, you might use religion as a filter to find that special someone
right.
on JDate or eHarmony, but it's really food. I have a friend who, and this is what inspired the personals, she's been dating for quite a while, and she met a man who was really good-looking. They went out one date. She was extremely excited, and then he called her the next day and said, "Hey, I had such a great time. Why don't I come over tonight and bring a hunk of cheese and a slab of meat, and we can grill?" And for anyone who loves food, to just have a hunk of cheese and a slab of meat is the most unsexy of offers.
Very true. Obviously, someone who did not place a great deal of emphasis on what was going into his mouth. Yeah. So this was the inspiration for how long have you been doing this?
We've been doing it for about 6 months, and it started with 1 degree of separation. And I think this is a differentiator. First, it was only my friends. They were the only ones who would entrust me to do this.
Uh-huh.
And then as word spread, it flew around the web. So then it was people who knew me, and now we're sort of at the third or fourth degree of separation. But I really try to vet each one and at least have an email exchange or a correspondence. It's almost like an old-time matchmaker, but a foodie matchmaker.
So you're trying to screen out any of, shall we say, the crazies?
Right, and no fast food lovers.
This is probably the most important
Absolutely.
Thing of all.
Absolutely. Now, are you in the market?
No, you know, Lisa, I'm happily paired. In fact, I could say I probably owe my career to the palate of my husband.
Oh, sweet.
But we do have a producer who is probably wide open. So
okay, you have to hook me up.
I think you will be hearing from someone from the Splendid Table Group shortly, shall
Excellent.
We say. All names will be avoided.
Absolutely. We don't reveal anything.
Lisa, I love this. I'm going to be checking in just for the smiles. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Lisa Schiffman is founder of TuttiFoodie.com. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Roald Dahl. A little nonsense now and then is cherished by the wisest men. The Splendid Table is brought to you by American Public Media and supported by Wiley, publishers of So Easy by Ellie Krieger. Simple, nutritious recipes for every meal of the week. So Easy by Ellie Krieger, available everywhere now for Mother's Day. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau and Jennifer Larson. Our technical director is Jennifer Lupke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Well, we're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.